Bernie Taylor explores the mythological connections and biological knowledge among prehistoric, indigenous, and ancient peoples.
And that same myth is told among the Chinese, the story of Pengu, who uses his axe to split the cosmos in two, which gives us yin and yang. The Vedic Greeks, the Norse, the Egyptians had a cosmic egg. You can go around the world and you can find this creation from a cosmic egg. And it's fundamentally the same story. It's the story of the Big Bang.
Bernie Taylor is the author of Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero.
But we accept the Big Bang because it's in our mythology. It's an archetypal idea that we carry within us from the stories that we tell and that the myths that we've heard for tens of thousands of years. That archetypal myth that we have to find a beginning and an end.
It is time for Progressive Spirit. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network, and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm, and click donate. For the Pacifica Radio Network, the Public Radio Exchange, Global Community Radio, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Shuck.
So we change the stories for our own times. The costumes change, the sets change, but the story remains the same. So the archetypal story, that hero's journey, that we answer the call and take that journey, it's throughout myth, throughout the world, whether you're an atheist or a spiritual person. What is your final thought? Think good thoughts. Prepare for those good thoughts. Don't worry about all the stuff in the past. Don't doubt yourself. Don't doubt your beliefs, whatever they are. But take that belief into your final moment. Because your final moment, whether that's 3 seconds, 10 seconds, or an eternity, that is your heaven.
My guest is Bernie Taylor. Bernie Taylor is from West Lynn, Oregon, Portland, Oregon. He's a naturalist, a thought leader, and author whose research explores the mythological connections and biological knowledge among prehistoric, indigenous, and ancient people. He has a couple of books in this area called Biological Time and Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. He addresses profound archaeological questions and mythological questions and theological questions, perhaps, and so he's with me to talk about Before Orion and the website beforeorion.com. Welcome, Bernie, to Progressive Spirit.
Well, John, thanks for having the show today. Let's do a shout-out to the Rose City Till I Die, RCTID.
There we go. All right. Well, Bernie, tell us a little about yourself. What a fascinating bio we have here.
Absolutely. So how did I step into it, or sort of walk into this? I was an outdoor person, a hunter, a fisherman. When I grew up, I collected bugs. And I remember one time when I was little, we were in Florida, and I found this three-horned beetle that I put in a paper bag in the car, and it got out in the middle of the night and, jumping on my sisters. But so I was always an outdoor person interested in the natural world and hiking and all that, so these sort of things, which is perfect here in the northwest of Oregon. That's why I came out here. And a few years ago, it was about 15 years ago, I asked the question of the timing of the salmon. Salmon's a big deal here, both politically, conservation-wise, economics. And the salmon run earlier or later from one year to the next. But the question always was, well, why the earlier or later? And we see this in newspaper, they're going to be early or later, and what are we going to do, and when are we going to go out there? Well, Native Americans, people who have been here for many thousands of years, they didn't read the newspapers, they didn't go online, they didn't ask their friend, were the fish running today? Because they migrated from point A to point B, sometimes over very long distances. They had to be there when the salmon were there. Otherwise, there was no food. Huge migrations of people. So how did they do it? And that was the topic of my book, Biological Time. That's where it started, but it ultimately evolved into other animals and plants. And the question is, or was, known among the Native Americans all along. That scientific question had eluded hundreds of thousands of academics and scientists was in the lore, the mythology, and the practices of Native Americans. in the Northwest here in the Columbia Basin, but they didn't know it. They actually didn't know it. It was in their practices and how they did things, but it wasn't in a conscious awareness that they could actually sit down with a scientist and explain this is how it works. And so that was the exploration of the biological time. And once I had the concept down, I recognized that, well, salmon eat invertebrates and they're eaten by bears, therefore this must be something up and down the food chain. And I showed how the concept of biological timing works across the biological spectrum. And it's in Native American calendars. And someone said to me, well, maybe it's deeper in time. And look at the earliest cave art was known at that time or dated was at Lascaux in France from about 17,000 years ago. And in this Lascaux cave, the animals are organized by seasonality. So in one chamber, you've got deer and what their equivalent of an elk that have their racks, big antlers. So that's a fall scene. And we picture a megaloceros who's blowing out steam and his neck is raised. So he's in a rut situation. He's bugling in the females. And another chamber, you find females, horse females or mares, that are pregnant. And then there's an auric dropping her young. Auric is a cow and cattle. Dropping her young. So we see seasonality in these things. And in each under each one of these images, we find nomenclature, series of dots, grids. And so I asked the question, was there any connection between these grids and dots in the on these images in the Paleolithic Europe from 17,000 years ago and the calendars and the practice of Native Americans. And in fact, there was. So they, of course, the deer haven't changed their rut and the salmon haven't changed their time and nor have the mares to drop their young in tens of thousands of years. And so it is in fact the same calendar that the Native Americans have as in Lascaux Cave in France. And I gave presentations to scientific groups, a lot of salmon work, and I gave to the Northwest Power Council here. And I remember giving a presentation to the power people, and at the end of it, everybody was silent. And then the leader of it said, "The Indians had it all along." And it was like one of those you know come to Jesus moments. But I also gave presentations to the Columbia Basin tribes, to the tribal councils, and their fish and wildlife people. And I remember giving one to the Umatilla, which was in the upper Columbia Basin. And this was fairly early on, and they were all talking among themselves, and they were throwing out a name, and the name was Tommy Thompson, Chief Tommy Thompson, who was the last of the great chiefs, and he died just about the time that the Dalles Dam went in, and I didn't know about Tommy Thompson, and I didn't know what he was, what he symbolized. Well, Tommy Thompson was not just the last; he ran the calendar. And they asked the question among themselves. And they didn't ask me. They said, "Why didn't he tell us?" But he did tell us. He told us in his stories, and he told us in the rituals. And he told us in his own being, every morning he woke up before the dawn, and he looked into the night sky, and he saw the stars. And when certain stars appeared, it told him what time of year it was, and what was the next thing would happen in his world. He looked at the birds, and he has a myth about the swallows. And if you ask Native Americans, how do you know when the salmon are coming up the Columbia River, the first salmon? They say, well, it comes 4 days after the swallows arrive. And they actually count 4 swallows in their myth. And so they're timing the salmon off of the swallows. But the swallows themselves were timed to rhythms, limbs of light and darkness, both the sun and the moon. And that was the work I started on. And then what happened, as I said, I'm pretty far ahead of where I was, and I was, you know, I was out there.
Yeah, and, wow. Keep going.
And so the next step was, I said, I'm going to put this on the shelf for 10 years. And I come back when, you know, the dust has settled. And now the practice of using the salmon timing is used as a standard, a protocol in salmon wildlife biology. This is all mainstream now.
Now it's mainstream.
Oh, it's mainstream,
From Western science drawing from ancient civilization.
Exactly.
That continues to exist today.
Exactly. Yeah, when it went mainstream, so that all stuff is mainstream now. And no one doubts it, no one questions all that sort of stuff. But what I did was, I came back 10 years later or so, and there were caves dated to earlier points in time, to 40,000 years ago in Spain, a place called El Castillo in the northern part of Spain, Cantabria. And the question, there's nomenclature under these or a series of dots on these panels as well. So I started counting the dots just like everybody else. And then I reasoned myself, there's one panel called the Gallery Disc, 10 meters across, so 30 feet across. It's a huge panel. It's got about 80 or so discs, red discs, each size of the palm of your hand. And I reasoned myself, well, this is a pretty big panel. Maybe there's something else there. The most common image or depicted image in Paleolithic art is of a mare, of a horse, and typically a pregnant mare. So I started looking for a pregnant mare. I didn't find a pregnant mare until almost 3 years later. But right away, I saw something else. I saw an elephant. So and there's an, so we have a, the fundamental.
So you're looking on this cave etching.
So I'm looking at actually a high-resolution image taken by a Spanish photographer.
Okay.
And so I'm looking at the image, and I see an elephant. And I said to myself, well, were there elephants in, at that time? And the answer was there were elephants. But they didn't look like that elephant. This was a different elephant. This one had a flat head, which is typical of an African elephant, whereas the European elephants at the time had a humped head, similar to Asian elephants. And so I kind of scratched my head. And pretty quickly I saw a lion, and actually two lions, the female licking the mare. That's very important. She's nuzzling him. The male lion. And his head is, of course, at the top of the panel where she's licking him. And so we're seeing a scene of two animals that are interacting with each other. And so I contacted some of my distant past. His name is George Schaller. George Schaller is considered the world's foremost wildlife biologist. He's the mentor of everybody such as Jane Goodall and so on. And I met George when I was in my early 20s when I was living in China. And I met him through a friend of a friend at a common event. And he didn't know me, but of course I remembered him because he was like the big show. And at that month, he was in National Geographic, a Rolex ad holding snow leopards. And so he was like, he's the big cheese. And he's in his 80s now, and he still is the big guy. And he travels around the world saving big cats. He's not interested in writing, doing what I'm doing, this sort of stuff. So I reached out to George, and George said, okay, I'll help you out. But I'm not gonna write anything, and I'm not going to draw any pictures, but I'll answer some questions. And we were just working at that time, the lions and the elephants. Well, hundreds of emails later, and a year and a half later, we had gone through dozens of animals. And what was most important was that we found animals that were uniquely of Europe and uniquely of Africa. And so at one end of the panel that is, we'll call it the north, you have all the European animals. On the south, we have the African animals, which included a giraffe. And in the middle, we have all the marine animals. We have a seal, we have a dolphin, we have crab, and we have a man swimming. And so we have a person that's traveled from Europe to Africa, and he's swum across the Strait of Gibraltar. He's taken that journey. And he traveled back again to tell the story and put it on the cave wall. And so what we're finding here is a story of a journey, of a hero. And in the same image, we find a character of an older man whispering into the ear of a young boy. And his ears and his eyes are just wide open, just these red discs form his eyes. And he's in amazement. You can see his mouth is pursed, and he's just intently listening. It's an empathetic spirit. We're not knuckle-dragging cavemen. They were people who thought and felt and had awareness of the natural world. And so we have these characters, the man speaking to the ear of the apprentice. What is he telling him? Well, he's telling him, from my perspective, of this story. Of the story of this individual, this hero that takes the journey from the north to the south, swims across the Strait of Gibraltar, and returns back again. And on that journey, he learns about himself. And so this becomes that monomyth, that story, that core story, the hero's journey that Joseph Campbell spoke about. And that's taught in high schools across the country today. It's the story that reaches deep into ourselves to learn who we truly are, both individually and as a species.
If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, this is a fascinating conversation with Bernie Taylor. He is the author of Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. You can find his website at beforeorion.com. So you're getting all of this from looking at a cave and drawing on the cave, but it isn't really that clear. I mean, you have to really look. You have to really look intently for all of these figures, and sometimes they're embedded within one another.
They're all they're embedded with each other, and that's the genius of it. But there's something. We're all wired differently, and there's something called neurodiversity. There's different ends of the spectrum. So somebody who does well in math will not likely do well in language arts. And there's people someone who does well in art, ceramic arts, may not be the best chemist. Because there are different skill sets. Our minds are all wired differently. I don't look at anybody as a genius. I look at people just being wired differently. And there's something called an embedded image test, and we've all taken them when we're kids. If you ever go to the diner, on the flip side of the kid's menu, you have some sort of like image of the animals in the zoo or the animals in the forest, and you have to kind of find them. Well, that's an embedded image test. And there's some kids who will look at that, and they will see all those animals in a blink of an eye. Other people will take an hour to find all the animals. And so that's a difference in how the brain is wired. And so the Paleolithic artist who embedded all these images in this cave wall and many other caves, he would have aced that test of on the flip side of the kid's menu.
Okay.
It just popped right at him. So we're all wired different. We have to understand that. And so what we do in modern society is we test kids throughout school to fit into certain boxes. And if they don't fit into the box, we try and find other ways that they can get into that box. But you can't put a square peg in a round hole in the same way that you can't create a Picasso from a mathematician. It just isn't going to happen. And so this was a test. This was a test not of who could count how many peanuts you could count, this or the red discs that are on the wall. This was a test. Could you see the forest through the trees? Could you see past those red discs? Could you see and ultimately face the elf in the room when you hadn't seen it before?
And so your story in your book has a conversation really between an apprentice and a mentor. So
yes.
So that was how did you come up with that? How did you know that?
Because it's an archetypal story within us. And archetypes are characters and figures that are within our world that we don't have – no one has to point that person out as a teacher to you or that as a mother and a child. We instantly recognize them when they come to us. So when the archetype is encountered, the story is evoked. And so I found this character, this old man speaking into the ear of the apprentice, and those archetypes spoke to me to say that this is the story. And so I approach the book as the teacher. I become the spiritual leader teacher who's telling the story to the reader, who is the apprentice. But as I take the reader through the story, the individual is challenged. And they're challenged with the same test that the apprentice would have been 34,000 years ago. They're challenged with that test. Well, now I'm kind of giving out the story a little bit. So if you tell somebody else about the book to read it, don't tell them.
Okay.
You know, it's okay.
All right.
Okay. But the apprentice would have stood before this panel and looked at the red discs and counted them just like everybody else. And just like the millions of scientists who saw these images in modern journals. So I didn't make a discovery of the panels themselves. Millions of people had seen these panels and the images in Science and Nature, Wall Street Journal, every place you could possibly imagine. This is an iconic image of Paleolithic art. It's almost like looking at Guernica and things popping out that no one had seen before. And I didn't dig this thing up and say, oh, I found this new panel. Millions of people had stared at this. And so the problem is that in our modern world, where people that become an archaeologist or anthropologist, they're of one type of wiring because that's what they're tested for. Whereas the people who made these panels, made images panels, they're of a different wiring. And so one really can't communicate with the other. In the same way, we talked earlier about Tommy Thompson, who's the Native American last chief, and that before the dawn, every morning, he looked at the stars. And those stars told him what was true about his future. And shamanic leader that followed him, I met. And he told me his vision of the world. And he said to me that every morning he too got up before the sun rose. And he looked at the stars and each star would tell him what would happen next in the cycle of their world and what ceremony would happen and so forth. And I showed him a star chart. What a star chart does, it tells you all the stars throughout the year. And he could see what I was doing, he was not easily to recognize that it could be true because in his mindset, This is a person who at that point was 40 years old, and he's an educated person. Okay, he's not stupid, but in his mindset, the truth came from the stars, and that as those stars rose, and Abraham, in Josephus, Abraham says that it's spoken of Abraham that he found rhythms between the animals and the stars, and if there's a rhythm that helps the animals, which includes us, therefore it's not at random. There's some sort of order in the cosmos. And that comes from that's in Josephus.
So let me back up just for a second then. So we're talking about the constellations And to me, they are balls of fire out there that kind of got there. But you're saying that they actually have a pattern themselves, or is this humans projecting a pattern?
A good point. So Abraham said that there is a pattern in the cosmos, a pattern among the stars and the moon and the sun that influences and affects life on Earth. And from that, he derived the concept of a great almighty that was sort of puppeteering things for our benefit. Okay, and my this person I met, the shamanic leader in the Columbia Basin, he had the same concept. And so it didn't matter whether or not the stars could be predicted a week before. He was interested that the star would be just appear just above that horizon. And so it's a different concept of spirituality. They're both true. Whether or not this, because the truth is that that star could implode before it reaches the horizon for the previous year. So stars come and go. And so there are different perspectives on the same truth. But we can take this concept of my spiritual leader acquaintance and Abraham back 34,000 years. And I mentioned that there are animals on this panel. And on the north end, we have a man. Followed by the man, there's an eagle, there's a horse, there's a dolphin, there's a seal. There's another man at the far south end, and we go up a little bit. We have the lions, we have bears, we have a bird, and we have a crocodile. Well, as we're going across, and there's many others, as we go across that night sky, well, the north end, we have Hercules, and the south end, that's Orion. So one hero rises, the other one sets. The second second animal being after Hercules is Aegea, the eagle. Then we have Pegasus, the horse. Dolphin is Pisces. The man is Orion. The Leo is the lion. Ursa Major is the bear. The great auk, now extinct great auk, is Cygnus. And Draco is the dragon, or actually the crocodile, who became the dragon, becomes Draco. So in that time and in that place, these people believed that the earth and sky were one in the same way as Abraham did and the Native Americans. And as this individual traveled on his journey from the Iberian Peninsula, what is now Europe, all the way to Africa, he sees each one of these animals in his terrestrial environment and then marine environment. But he also projects that into the night sky. So he's not just guided by the animals and environment. He's guided by the stars above him. They tell him what is true in his world, and they guide him on his journey.
So tell me more about the hero's journey and Joseph Campbell and how this connects again.
How is Joseph Campbell? Well, Joseph Campbell described a monomyth. And he went around the world and he said, and looked at the mythology people, and he said, there is a common myth. There's common elements that there's a hero that goes on this journey. And he leaves the place of normality. And he accepts the call to go somewhere beyond. And as he travels on his journey, he encounters typically some sort of wizard or shamanic leader, or call him Gandalf, call him Yoda, you know, pull the thousands of names out there. And on that journey, he's given magical potions or abilities, and he's given, you know, inner knowledge. But he also is accompanied by other people or beings who give him strength. So on The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy goes on her journey. She answers the call. And in her dream, she's helped by the Tin Man, and the Lion, and the Scarecrow. There are other people that help her on her journey. They are the Fellowship of the Ring, one would say, as all the different characters we find in the Tolkien genre. And so this person goes on the journey, but ultimately they have to leave all their helpers behind. And and just as Frodo had to climb Mount Mordor, he had to climb the mountain to throw the ring in. But Frodo has to individually throw the ring into the fire, the ring of evil. And then he returns back to tell the story. But what Frodo learns on his journey, he learns about himself. And he encounters Gollum. And Gollum is his mirror opposite. It's his shadow self. And Gollum is trying to kill him throughout this process to get the ring. And Frodo realizes that if he kills Gollum, he becomes Gollum. And it's that same story fine in the second Star Wars movie, The Empire Strikes Back. At the Dagobah cave, Luke Skywalker is with Yoda. And Luke asks, what's down in the cave? And Yoda says, you're really not ready to go there yet. And Luke says, well, what do I need to go there? And Yoda says, all you can bring is yourself. In the same way as Frodo climbs Mount Mordor. And Luke goes into that cave, and he's confronted with his enemy, or his shadow self, in the Jungian sense, Luke Skywalker. I'm sorry. Darth Vader. So Luke battles, pulls out his lightsaber as Darth Vader imitates. And they battle, they swashbuckle back and forth. And Luke takes the blow and lobs off the helmet and, of course, in her head of Darth Vader. It falls to the ground. And who does he see within the face of the helmet? He sees himself. And so in the hero goes on this journey. And if he succumbs, one of the tests is, do you succumb to evil? And that's really a theme in modern times. Do we today become Trump to fight Trump? Or do we have a greater call? And that is the lesson of Darth Vader, and that's the lesson of Frodo and Gollum.
This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Bernie Taylor. He's the author of Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. More to come. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen, and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. You're listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Bernie Taylor, and we're talking about prehistoric societies and the myth of the hero. You know, the Epic of Gilgamesh came to mind as you're talking, the first written big epic myth like that. But we're talking far deeper time than Gilgamesh.
Exactly.
In terms of the same story repeating on cave walls, in the stars, certainly probably before we can only speculate, but before we even have these cave walls that we can see today.
Absolutely.
Humans have been doing this for, a million years?
Yeah. So Gilgamesh is actually a really good story to bring up. And the Epic of Gilgamesh is our earliest, what's called, known written work. And it was dug up in the sands of the Middle East about 4,500 years ago. And from Gilgamesh, we find this man who goes on this journey. And he has helpers, and he faces himself. And at the end of it, he returns back to where he started. And he climbs the steps of York in a different mindset. And I actually modeled Before Orion after Gilgamesh, in that the hero starts at point A, but he returns to point A at the end, but he sees it in a different way. He comes back to express a story. So Gilgamesh is important because he is the worst, the most horrible person you could possibly meet. Okay, and it starts off. We've had names like him in the press and the media fairly recently. Okay, and so what we learn about Gilgamesh is that mankind has the same problems today as we had 4,500 years ago. Okay, and so psychologists, people in literature and so forth, they look at Gilgamesh as like the standard, say, hey, you know, we can say that we've had no intellectual or psychological evolution in 4,500 years. We have better toys. You know, we have iPads, we have Skype, we have, you know, I got a digital microphone in front of me. But psychologically, intellectually, we haven't changed. Okay. And Gilgamesh is brilliantly written as well as a story. So today we've now pushed that story of the hero's journey back at least 30,000 years. And stories are not first etched into the walls of caves. They're told around campfires. And when they're told around campfires, they're traveled from one campfire to another. And this story probably goes back hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years.
So does that story change, though? I mean, when I'm thinking of Gilgamesh and really the kind of the beginning of agriculture and civilization that's based on that. Has the story, we're talking about pre-civilization, was the story different at all then?
Well, the story changes for the social environment. And Moana, the Disney movie Moana, is a really good example. And Moana starts from a place of normality. She wants to go beyond the reef. She answers the call. And She travels on her boat, that's exactly the right word for the craft, and she travels by the stars, which is quite interesting, which is fundamentally the same story as we find in this cave image. But so Moana is the hero. We have a female hero, which is different, would never happen in Gilgamesh. So we change the stories for our own times. The costumes change, the sets change, but the story remains the same. So the archetypal story, that hero's journey, that we answer the call and take that journey, is within, it's throughout myth, throughout the world. But in Native Americans might have had the hero character as a coyote. And in Africa, it could have been some other animal. Many, could have been a lion, And of course, in modern times, we have projected the story of the Lion King, this hero's journey story. And so the stories are within us. The sets change, the costumes change, but the fundamental hero's journey remains the same.
Bernie Taylor is my guest. He's the keeper of the website beforeorion.com and author of Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. So what is Before Orion?
So Before Orion means before the Greeks. So Orion is a Greek word. Now the Greeks, and so I'm saying there was knowledge, there was years before the Greeks. What's actually quite interesting about Orion is that the Greek record of astronomy is what we use today. And Ptolemy from the second century CE was, we believe, is the architect of that. But there is at least 20 of the exact same constellations in the exact same place that Ptolemy had as we find in this Paleolithic image 34,000 years ago. So did Ptolemy look into the night sky and find them himself, or did Ptolemy have a deeper source? Ptolemy was also the librarian at the Library of Alexandria. He was the bookworm, and what did we lose in that library is probably fathomable. My guess is that Ptolemy did not go to the cave himself, but that he had an earlier source where people had described what they had seen and put them into the Library of Alexandria, which he held the keys to. But what's very important is that we look at science as starting with the Greeks. And of course, the Chinese will say science started with them, the Western civilization with the Greeks. But the truth is that science started 34,000 years ago, at least 34,000 years ago, because Ptolemy brought that record of astronomy, carried it forth to the modern world from his own cartography, his writings, and what we learned of the cosmos. Our understanding of the cosmos from a scientific perspective is grounded in a Paleolithic myth that is on the cave wall from 34,000 years ago. It's mind-boggling.
That is mind-boggling. In fact, you caught me in a moment of silence right then. So you're talking about modern science, or not modern science, but science beginning because of this cave wall found 34,000 years ago. Now, it could be even older than that.
Yes, and not found by me per se, but by the Greeks, the Romans, right. Babylonians, Egyptians, all these other people had been there and had seen the images and took what they learned from them. Now, we can also talk about modern science as being tied to this as well.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that point about when we talk about, say, our modern understanding of universal origins, Big Bang, all those kinds of things. Is that part of our?
Oh, absolutely, and that's a really important concept. And so there's people out there say, well, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God, and I'm a religious person, or spiritual person, I believe in some sort of great almighty or creation. You're all believing the same story, I'm going to tell you right now, and I'm going to take you through the steps.
All right.
Okay, so 34,000 years ago in this cave wall, we have the image of a man, this character Hercules, who holds the egg. It's the cosmic egg. And all these constellations that I previously mentioned, they actually overlap each other. And we had the great auk was the biggest bird at that time in that place in Europe, who laid the largest egg, which became the cosmic egg. And when the cosmic egg hatches, the universe exploses, the cosmos. It's the Big Bang. And that same myth is told among the Chinese, the story of Pengu, who uses the cosmic egg and uses his axe to split the cosmos in two, which gives us yin and yang. The Vedic Greeks, the Norse, the Egyptians had a cosmic egg. You can go around the world and you can find this creation from a cosmic egg. And it's fundamentally the same story. It's the story of the Big Bang. Father Lemaître, a Belgian, hypothesized that there was a Big Bang. and something about the primordial atom, but he hypothesized it, and he showed it mathematically, and he brought it to the scientists, cosmologists of his time, and they said, you know, this is just another form of religion. Einstein himself said, your math is correct, but your physics is atrocious. Pope Pius XII, who at that time was the Nazi, he supported the Nazis, okay, we'll just put it out there. Pope Pius XII said, science has found a creation, therefore there must have been a creator, which is very similar to the story of Abraham. It's a similar story. So time goes by, and they're pretty much saying that the scientists came out against Father Mantor. It's ludicrous, until Hubble observed an expanding universe. And so now this story of this Big Bang is the common belief. And when the Big Bang was first described, it was as a joke to Father Mantor, as it's an orgasmic event. And so, but now we use that commonly. But there are actually multiple views of the cosmos or the universe or multiverses. And I mean, it's a big field out there. Pick, you know, it's like going to a Chinese restaurant, you know, pick your, you know, what you want for dinner tonight, because there's so many different versions. But we accept the Big Bang because it's in our mythology. It's an archetypal idea that we carry within us from the stories that we tell, and that the myths that we've heard for tens of thousands of years, that archetypal myth that we have to find a beginning and an end.
So if you push physicists on this, they ultimately will...
Oh, yeah, you asked them the question. If you ask my father and answer, it's like I'm a deep, dark secret with them.
Okay.
But physicists, you know, some will say, well, there was a Big Bang, some say, well, the multiverse, so there are multiple Big Bangs. And, you know, the Big Bang is, you know, if you crack one chicken egg. The multiverse is, you know, go into Costco and crack all the eggs. Okay. And so so physicists know this. But they argue among themselves, you know, what is the truth or not? And the Big Bang itself, if you listen to a physicist, there's a lot of assumptions made, a lot of models. And so they're seeking a truth, but they're seeking the same truth as a religious man. They're seeking the truth of the great mysteries. What became before and what came after? Or what came before and where do we go, both individually and as the cosmos? We're all asking the same question. 34,000 years ago in that cave, they were asking the question of how was the cosmos formed? Where do we come from? And then where do we go? So our moment on this earth is barely a breath between these two great mysteries. And it's unfathomable. We may never find how everything began, if it ever began, or there's a continuous cycle. We may never understand where we go in the end. But in that end, and in that time, in that place, it is what you believe that matters. So if you believe that your final thought is the face of Donald Trump, that is what you will take into your eternity, whether that eternity is 5 seconds or some number we can't imagine. If you believe that it's a smiling child or your laughing spouse or some family environment or, you know, a happy world, that is what you will take into your heaven, into your eternity. So what you believe is important, but whatever it is, make sure it's a good thought and keep it to the end.
Bernie Taylor is my guest. BeforeOrion.com is his website. His book that came out in 2017 is Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. And in 2004, he wrote Biological Time. So science and religion really converge, in a sense, on this search of the truth of the beginnings and the ends.
We can't escape from conversion. Because we can't tell a different story. We have this narrative within our psyche. And this narrative goes back for a very long period of time. And I'm going to say at least hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years ago. We can't escape from it. We have to, well, so here's actually a pretty good example. So in the Paleolithic myth, 34,000 years ago, the cosmic egg expands and explodes in all the constellations. Well, the story is a little different then. The story then was a June time period when the great auk lays her egg. And so in the Paleolithic mind, it was actually circular. So every year the cosmos, every year there was an expansion of the cosmos. And every year there was a circularity. And so everything has been done before will be done again. And that is the story of the Paleolithic version of the cosmic egg. But as we'll call classical people, the Greeks, Egyptians, the Romans, and so forth, they looked at this. Their interpretation was not as a circular environment, which is fundamentally how Native Americans see the world, And theirs was as there had to be a beginning, which is, of course, the in Abrahamic fashion. There has to be a beginning. There has to be a creation. So we have modified that myth. But the fundamental parts of the myth exist that instead of a circular for one year or the next that the cosmos is reborn, we tell it as there was a beginning. There was a creation and there was a light, which, of course, is the same story as the Big Bang.
Now, this question is going to sound unfair, and it is unfair because I'm going to ask you to do something that project to the future a little bit, because I'm looking at the world that we're in, and our population has exploded to 8 billion people. We have climate change, we have oil, energy crises. One could look at this and say we're headed for the walking dead. Has this type of problem been understood in your understanding of the mythology of human history in the past? I mean, are we at a unique point, perhaps in our own human quest?
We believe we're always unique, but we're not unique because we're retelling those same stories. Well, here's – so 12,000 years ago, Paleolithic art or cave art ended in Europe. But in a big way, in 12,000 years ago, it shows up in the Greater Sahara. The Greater Sahara is now the largest art gallery in the world. And it's the same animals we find. And they're huge animals. The elephants, and there's rhinoceros, and there's alligators, so which is now desert. You could walk for days now and come to a rock panel that has an alligator. So 12,000 years ago, the Sahara had great lakes, greater sized lakes than we have the Great Lakes in the United States. The world keeps changing. So we think, you know, there. If anybody says there's no global warming, whatever. But you can't say there's no climate change, because in 4,000 years, 5,000 years, the Greater Sahara will have those lakes again, because the monsoon rains will come north again. And when those monsoons came north 12,000 years ago, people left the Iberian Peninsula and moved into the Greater Sahara. So we'll constantly move. And we constantly change. And we always think that we're unique. And I'm sure that the Greeks pondered these same questions that we are today. And the Greeks were at the height of intellectual scientific development for their age. At least how we in the Western world see it. The Chinese don't see it that way. Okay.
Yeah. So our time limit is so small, the individual human life versus deep time.
Exactly. And so we will always change. I believe that John and I, our descendants, will stand before these microphones or whatever medium we have in 1,000 years, and we will re-ask these same questions. And we will say at that point that we are at a unique point in time, that we're, you know, the world is changing, climate changing, we've got, madman, the mad king and all these sort of things. But it isn't. And so how I see the world, at least I've seen the world since I've reflected in writing this book, because I've took my own journey through the 18 chapters, is that the... I see a cosmic perspective, and that we've gone through much worse in past times that we're going through today in this political environment. And, you know, the world will keep changing, but psychologically, we're not going to change. We're going to tell that same story. There will never be a utopian. The only utopian environment would be that which we have in our heads at the moment that we pass on. And hopefully we do see a utopian environment. And that is what we take with us to the end. Because if you go into that end with scary monsters, that is your eternity. And that's not the eternity that I see. So when I die in my final place, I will see my loved ones. I will see smiles and I will hear laughter. And that will be my eternity. That will be my heaven.
The challenge, as I was reading your book and seeing and looking at some of your videos, tell me if I missed this, but it's really facing our fears.
It's facing our fears.
And you know, as you mentioned, that fear is a future story. Fear is something that hasn't happened.
Exactly. So if you see people, some people are afraid of spiders, and they'll see a spider in the wall. Well, what are the chances that spider is going to jump across the wall at them? It's not going to happen. And it's just the possibilities are fairly remote. So we have fears of things that are not going to happen. And so how I came, I had a moment. I had that what we call luminous moment that kind of came to face myself. And I was in deep pain. I had an injury. I was bedridden for 2 months. And in that moment, I had sciatic nerve pain on both sides. And I was, to get my mind off the pain, I was working on these images. And then something happened. I went into like a Shavasana breath at the end of yoga, where you have your death. And in that moment, the pain went away. And something else happened in that moment is I could see these images, animals just popped out at me. And I hadn't seen the giraffe before, and I hadn't seen the dolphin, and they just all of a sudden jumped out at me. So something was rewired in my brain. The unique part of what I was wearing my distant glasses at the time, mistakenly. So my eye was out of focus. And so what I learned in that place is that vision does not come from your eyes. Vision comes from within. And I believe that was one of the tests. And I believe that that Paleolithic apprentice walked into this cave, and he counted the red disc, and his teacher tasked him, and he started crying. And in his despair, he himself came to see that same vision that I did. And what's most interesting about my vision is that, unlike St. Paul, who had that luminous moment, that light, that I can show people and I can test people, and that I can show that this is what happened in my point of so-called transcendence, or my luminous moment in the Jungian sense, and this would other people who hadn't reached that point couldn't see. So it's not just neurodiversity. So neurodiversity brings you so far. And what I believed in that moment happened was my mind was rewired. And what I gave, how I could see all this, was not that I just gave up the pain, but I actually faced a fear in my life. And the fear in my life was that if something happened to me, what would happen to my daughter, who I was, I was fundamentally a primary parent, and what would be her path in life? And she was in middle school at the time, and now she's in high school, she's graduating, she's going off to college, and everything is just wonderful. But so my giving up my greatest fear in life opened up my perspectives so that I could I see the world differently. And so, yes, there could be a mad king out there, but the mad king he's a fear that we all have to overcome. And we have to believe in the system, we have to believe in ourselves, and it'll all work out. But we have to face our own fears, and we have to, we have to see that light in a sense. And very interesting, I'm not the only one, St. Paul and I are the only ones that had this experience. Many people have had it. Jane Goodall tells a story that in her story, her husband has just died from cancer, and it was a hard cancer over a long period of time. And she walks, she's in the Gombe Forest, and she's following the chimpanzees. The rain comes down, and she follows the chimpanzee into a grove. And as the rain stops, the light comes in from the sky. But her vision changes. She sees the world, or she sees spider webs as diamonds. And she hears the sounds of the birds and the insects. She's never heard them before. She's a different awareness. And she has let go of her husband and that fear of being alone. So, and Jane Goodall, at that moment, she realizes that, or in her perspective, she sees the world as the chimpanzees see them. Completely different perspective. And what Jane does following that time is she also recognizes that she can't save the chimpanzees or save animal beings by hiding in the Gombe Forest. So Jane Goodall then goes off into the world, and she's been traveling ever since, telling her story, not just about just her personal story of life and about chimpanzee, but she's going around the world supporting conservation projects. And she says that to be good to animals is to make better people of ourselves. And that is so true. And we can take that back to the Paleolithic artist 34,000 years ago. Almost all the animals that are depicted on this panel have the juvenile next to them. And so we have an Iberian lynx who's the kitten nuzzles against her chin. It's a beautiful scene. And we have a giraffe whose molted pattern protects the juvenile, whose head comes up under the chin. So we have these nurturing scenes of being better than animals and learning about ourselves. And this Paleolithic shaman, or the apprentice on his journey, he actually overlaps with most of these juveniles. And so the head of the juvenile giraffe intersects with the head of the apprentice on his journey. And so that the mother giraffe is protecting the young, the apprentice himself. And so we can learn about the animals in our world by not being above them per se, as being as part of an ecosystem. And that is a place that we're coming back to in our so-called modern time. We're making a complete circle from where we were 34,000 years ago. And that circle is important because that will be I don't believe we're ever going to blow up the world. I don't believe that there'll be winners and losers. Things are going to change. But I believe that coming back to this place and understanding that the canary tells us our own health, and that the salmon in the rivers tell us the health of the ecosystem, because many animals feed off of what has of the dying salmon, including ourselves. And so to have a concept of preservation of the worldview of animal beings and plants is to follow the vision of Jane Goodall, but it's also to follow the vision of the Paleolithic artist who took that journey, who learned from all these animals on his way, and he looked to the night sky and he saw them projected, and he came back to tell the story of his journey, that same journey we tell today in our myth and lore.
This has been fascinating. My guest has been Bernie Taylor. He is the author of Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero, and before that, Biological Time. His website is beforeorion.com. We have about 1 minute left. 1 minute sermon.
Well, going back to that concept of what do you take with in the end, whether you're an atheist or a spiritual person, what is your final thought? You know, think good thoughts. Prepare for those good thoughts. Don't worry about all the stuff in the past. Don't doubt yourself. Don't doubt your beliefs, whatever they are. But take that belief into your final moment. Because your final moment, whether that's 3 seconds, 10 seconds, or an eternity, that is your heaven.
Progressive Spirit is heard every week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed every week through the Pacifica Radio Network, the Public Radio Exchange, and Global Community Radio. Progressive Spirit is on the broadcast schedule of over 20 stations around the country. Ask your favorite station to add Progressive Spirit to its weekly lineup. You can download Progressive Spirit for free on iTunes, Google Play, Podomatic, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast app. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow also on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schock. Be well.